All right, we're going to get started. Good afternoon, everyone. I call this meeting of the Human Services Policy Committee to order. Members, please take your seats. We have a quorum. Before we begin our agenda today, I'd like to remind the committee of a few housekeeping rules. Everyone in the audience must be seated when they're in the hearing room. Please, no sitting or standing in the walkways or in the aisles. This will allow us to keep the accessible seating available to those who need it. Please leave all signs outside of the hearing room. All testifiers who have signed up in advance have been provided time to testify. The chair has the right to reserves the right to impose time limits on comments. Time limits are provided so we can keep our meeting on time and hear from as many people as possible. We'll usually ask the room if there are further testifiers who would like to speak, but that may not always be possible. Thank you for your understanding and your adherence to these rules. Next on the agenda is meeting minutes. Could I get a motion to approve our meeting minutes from Tuesday, March 19th? Representative Finke?
So moved, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Finke moves the minutes from March 19th, 2024. Any questions or amendments? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. All right, first on the agenda, we have our Chair Fisher. Members, let's see, where are we at right here? Okay. All right, Chair Fisher, would you like to move and explain your bill?
Thank you, Chair Curran. I appreciate the opportunity to move to re-refer House File 4949 to the Human Services Finance Committee. This is a bill that makes various changes to long-term consultation services, also known as MIN choices. Long-term care consultation services provide screening, assessment, and information and education services to help individuals access and decide an appropriate level of long-term care services that meet their needs and reflect their preferences. Long-term care consultation services are available to any individual with long-term or chronic needs. And I have several testifiers here. If we could turn it over to our testifiers, they will give a little bit more detail on why we need the bill.
All right, great. Sounds good. Thank you, Chair. First on our testifier list is Brittany Hernandez-Wilson. And on deck, we have Katie Molinaire. And if I see your name is on deck, if you could go ahead and be prepared to be next so we can keep moving quickly, I'd appreciate it. All right, welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brittany Hernandez-Wilson. I am the Equity and Justice Director for the ARC Minnesota. I'm also a proud disabled person who was born with a rare joint and muscle condition. And due to this condition, I use an electric wheelchair to move around in the world. For as long as I can remember, I have been in the system. I remember growing up and having social workers and nurses come to my house to determine if I was able to stay on the waiver. My mom would get so anxious because everything was dependent on these assessments. I remember being coached to think about things from my worst day. And it always felt really dehumanizing to have to picture my worst day imaginable just to be able to justify and explain why I needed help with my daily activities of living. I'm 36 now, and I've definitely gone through at least two decades of these MIN Choices assessments, even though my condition will never change. And I really want you to put yourself in my shoes, and in thousands of Minnesota's shoes who go through this every single year. Being made to describe the exact same things about us just so that we can continue to receive these life-giving services. I'd also like to mention the fact that for many, the person interviewing us is often a complete stranger. So I ask you, how would it feel to be forced to tell a complete stranger very intimate details about yourself? What would your life be like on the worst day that you can imagine? It's not fun. It's degrading and stressful, to say the least. I try my best to frame myself in a way that doesn't make me feel horrible about living my life, because my life isn't horrible. I just need personal care assistance, a modified van, and other waivered supports to be able to access the world in the same way that everyone else does. But this is what thousands of Minnesotans go through every single year, which is why I strongly encourage you to support this bill, which would allow for a reassessment every 3 years. This would be a tremendous relief for those who don't experience much change year to year. it would give power back to the people in these systems to be able to choose whether or not they want to go through 2 hours of assessments just to be certified for the same services. This change would also relieve a lot of time and paperwork for our counties and MnChoice's assessors. And when we talk about person-centered planning, this is it. We are centering the person and their lived experience, trusting them with the choice to decide. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next is Katie Molinar. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Katie Molinar. I serve as a Social Services Deputy Director at Ramsey County. I oversee our Aging and Disability Services and MnChoice's division. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, or MACSA, to testify in support of House File 4949. Many counties are experiencing increased demand for MnChoice's assessments and support planning for older adults and people with disabilities. Due to the current demand, many individuals must wait to be scheduled for their initial assessments, and more lead agencies are falling outside the statutory requirements for those assessments. This is a disservice to residents and puts additional pressure on staff. The statewide experience of waiving certain administrative requirements during the COVID-19 pandemic demonstrated that those efficiencies did not diminish program effectiveness, but rather enhanced it. Reducing the complexity and increasing efficiencies of the MnChoice's assessment is essential as NEAT continues to grow statewide. This bill, taking those lessons, will accomplish four things. First, allow counties currently contracting for personal care assistance reassessments to continue using a contracted provider while working with DHS on a plan. Second, allow initial assessments to remain valid for 365 days rather than 60 days. Third, change the initial visit from county staff from within 20 calendar days to 20 business days. And fourth, reduce unnecessary annual reassessments for case scenarios where the person's needs have not changed. We believe reducing complexity of the MnChoice's assessment and related processes would decrease the amount of time per assessment, better serve residents, and increase the number of people that we can serve. We have been in conversation with disability advocates from the ARC Minnesota, including people with lived experience, the Department of Human Services, and other stakeholders regarding this language and have received positive feedback. We look forward to continuing these discussions. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. At this point, I would open it up to any members of the public that are wishing to testify on this bill. Not seeing any, we'll turn it over to member discussion. First up, Representative Hicks. No, apparently not. Representative Backer?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Chair Fisher, do the counties and tribes, what do they think about this? Do they see this as something workable? Because everything we have to provide is through the county.
Correct.
Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Vice Chair Frederick. My understanding is they do. I know that my local county was one that was one of those that was pushing it very strongly, and they felt what this was going to do is make it much easier for them in terms of getting the work done and removing duplicate paperwork that's out there, make it more efficient for them in the long term.
Representative Backer?
How about DHS, where, you know, I know this is not something that has just happened in the last week. This has been working on for years now. Where does DHS have some concerns? I don't know if there's someone in the audience or if you can answer that question.
Chair Fisher.
Vice Chair Frederick, I have not heard from anyone from DHS. I was kind of thinking if they had any major issues that they would have raised them before now, but I've not personally talked to them on it. If you'd like, you could call somebody down.
I don't know. Do we have a friend?
I would just say that we're pretty good partners with the state agencies, and as Chair Fisher said, too, that if there was any comments or concerns that they needed to make, they certainly would have been reaching out. So I don't know if there's a specific question.
No, sometimes you don't hear from them, so if they're not here, that's fine. I mean, I'm sorry, Representative Chair. That's all. Sometimes we don't hear from them.
Okay.
You know, that's all.
Well, we'll let Mr. Burdick come in and chime in.
Mr. Burdick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Matt Burdick with the Department of Human Services. I do understand we've been working with the proponents of this bill, and apologies, Representative Fisher, if we haven't closed the loop with you, working through outstanding issues with this bill in terms of what's allowable federally, but I think everyone's working in good faith on that. And We do not have our resident expert here today, so that's the extent of my knowledge on the bill.
Sounds good. I know it has an additional committee stop, too, so plenty of opportunity for conversations. Any other discussion? Not seeing any. Chair Fisher, would you like to close in comments and renew your motion?
I will thank you for the opportunity to present the bill. I'll go right to renewing my motion that to re-refer House File 4949 to Human Services Finance Committee.
Chair Fisher renews his motion to re-refer House File 4949 to the Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say nay. Motion passes. Next on the agenda is House File 4392, also from Chair Fisher. Would you like to move and introduce your bill?
Thank you, Chair Frederick. I move to re-refer my House File 4392 to Ways and Means. And letting folks know the reason we're going to Ways and Means is that there's one very small section that it feels like it might have a fiscal note on it. It doesn't appear that there may be a cost, but we want to verify that by going to Ways and Means.
I also see that there is a DE1 author's amendment. Would you like to move and introduce your amendment?
Yes, it's just a small little amendment. What this is first of all, I want to move to adopt the DE1 author's amendment. And before I explain it, I want to first of all say thank you to all the folks that helped pull this together from the staff side. I know that there's a lot of work that came in from Matt Burdick, Nicole Wan, Elise Bailey, Christy Graham, Ari Dayton, Nicole Stockert, and Ann Bops from DHS. Most importantly, our staff person people here, Ms. Danelle Pinelli from Nonpartisan Staff, and all the incredible advocates for working together to get this all assembled in such a quick time. I appreciate your efforts. The bill that we have before us, 4392, is a combination of a large number of bills that have been before us throughout the entire year. And as I grab out my notes here, 4392 in the DE amendment, we've got bills from Representative Coran, Acub, Hansen, Keel, Edelson, myself, Chair Noor, Vice Chair Frederick, Representative Vernick, and Hicks in here. And I'll go through a little bit as to some of the different sections here. You know, the first article we have is on disability in sections 1 and 2. These are from Representative Coran's bill, House File 3938. It exempts certain licensed facilities from local government rental licensing regulations. Next, we have sections 3 and 7. This is House File 3941 from a Coran bill. It modifies home and community-based standards provisions. And then we've got from my House File 4392 as amended, I have sections 8, 11, 14, 21, 23. This is the DHS Human Services Policy Bill. It's clarifying usage from home and community-based waiver services, modifies PCA and CFS remote assessments. Section 9 is 3711 from Representative Hicks' bill, which modifies out-of-home respite services for children. Section 10 is House File 4158, which is another Hicks bill, modifies MAEPD. Sections 12 and 13 is House File 3940, Representative Coran bill, and it prohibits lead agencies from including additional processes or requirements that result in delay or approval of implementation of technology for people on disability waivers. Section 22 in Article 1 is House File 4073. This is from Representative Jess Hansen and allows for remote worker training, developments, and development of services under CFS. Article 2 is under deaf, blind, and hard of hearing services. The sections 1 through 16 was from my House File 4392, which was the Human Services Policy Bill, modernizes deaf and hard of hearing statutes. Section 17 is House File 4528, which was Representative Hicks' bill, modifies membership of the Commission of Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing. Then we move on to Article 3. This is the addressing minimum wage for persons with disability. This all came through from my House File 4392. Article 4 is Aging Services. Section 1 and Part of 4 is House File 4308 from Representative Keel. It modifies long-term care consulting options. Then Sections 2, 3, and part of 4, which is House File 4480, that's from Representative Knorr. And this deals with DHS nursing facility policy, provides for increased transparency in nursing homes, related parties to see transactions, and removes a mandated legislative report. Article 5 is substance use disorder. A lot is happening here. Sections 1 to 7, 13 to 16, 18 to 20 is from my House File 4392. This is the DHS policy bill. It makes technical corrections to behavioral health provisions. Then we have sections 8, 14, 16, and 21, which is House File 4149, which is Vice Chair Frederick's bill, modifies behavioral health licensing eligibility and modifies the Paperwork Reduction Act. Then we have sections 9 to 11 and 22. This was the House File 4014. It was Representative Akam's bill. It modifies rules on opioid treatment program medication dispensing for take-home usage. House File 4548 is sections 12 and 15. This is again from Vice Chair Frederick. It prohibits classification of recovery peers as independent contractors. Then we have section 17, which is House File 3954, also a Vice Chair Frederick provision. It modifies sober home requirements related to opiate antagonists and medications for opioid use disorder. Then we have Article 6, which is direct care and treatment. This is House File 4362, which was an Edelson bill. It is DHS direct care and treatment technical bill. And then finally, Article 7 is the miscellaneous. It's Section 1 to 6, House File 4552, which was Representative Vernig's bill, and it removes expired mandated legislative reports from statute. So that is a very quick high-level view of the House File 4392, and I do understand we also have a number of other amendments out there, but I do know we have to first adopt this.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Discussion to the DE amendment before we take, the DE amendment before we move on. No. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Motion prevails. All right, so we'll start with another author's amendment to the bill, to the A8 author's amendment.
Okay, the A8 author's amendment, just a second here as I'm pulling that out. All right, my A8 author's amendment is, it's small technical changes and date changes from DHS. It addresses technical changes to medium intensity. It's affixed to some language that it's long for medium intensity to continue on. It was originally being phased out. And this was some work that was done between MARTAP and MARCH. And this is an amendment that also aligns with the Senate version. I would ask for your support.
Discussion to the A8 author's amendment. Not seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A8 author's amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Motion carries. Next we have the A2 amendment being presented by, who's offering the A2?
Okay, thank you.
Representative Baker.
That would be me. Thank you. Come prepared. You like that, don't you? Mr. Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to bring some ideas back that we've talked about already during during committee. The A2 is, it talks again about our special minimum wage, our attempt to make sure that we understand what we want to accomplish and what the issues might be that we are not intending to do. I just want to share this with the committee. Again, since our conversations, again, we are on a trajectory, folks, to bring it down. It is declining in a nice manner. Last year we sat here, there were 6,500 or so people in the state of Minnesota that were under that special classification to do special work with their, many different kinds of limitations and physical restraints and all those kind of things. And this has been a program that helps people develop skills so they can actually get out and make more money. We heard great testimony this year, too, from people. I like a lot of you folks, you probably call your local experts, because I'm not an expert in this area. But I'm an employer, and I want to give everybody the chance to do well. This is obviously a very challenging thing to do. I think that before we just eliminate it by certain dates, before we just say it's done by this date, members, I think we have to have a better plan of how that is going to look if the current 3,300 people that are under this rule of a special minimum wage, how can we make sure that there's 500 or 1,000 left that will have nothing? And I'm concerned, like my local expert back at West Central Industries has said, they are on a downward trajectory. Companies are either leaving the state that used to do this, or they're just choosing different methods. I think people know that the writing is on the wall. My concern is, though, after 2 years, 3 years or so, if there's still 500 out there and this just has to end, I want to know what that plan is to help those left there still. I think we all agree that let's move them towards something that's better. Should we have a floor to a special minimum? You know, we heard earlier that there was something less than a dollar an hour. Well, I think nobody wants that. I think it's important that as legislators, we work through this. We take our time with this. I'd like to offer the A2 amendment, Mr. Chair, and have more discussion if you want to. I understand the outcome is not going to be probably what I want, but I want to make sure that we as members have a plan of what that's going to look like. Just having a date, I don't think is a plan. So I'll offer that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Sounds good. Chair Fisher, your response.
Thank you, Vice Chair Frederick. Thank you, Representative Baker, for bringing it up. I know this is a very difficult issue that we've wrestled with for the last couple of years around here. I will say that, yes, we do have some plans that are already out there. We put in a large amount of money for people to be in, to provide the support services so that different operations are able to make a plan to make sure that everyone is taken care of and no one's left behind. Because that's one thing that, as I've talked to everybody, we want to make sure that everybody is feeling doing things are fulfilling, rewarding, and being properly compensated in the process. I would say that at this point I'm going to say no to the amendment, but I will also say this is probably not going to be the last time we discuss it. This is something that I see that we're going to continue to discuss because it comes down to what you're saying, Representative Baker, is we want to make sure that we've got the services so that we make sure that everyone is being taken care of and doing things that are meaningful for them, regardless of what we have for an end date right now. We're going to continue to visit this not only this year, but next year and the year after, to continue monitoring to make sure that we haven't left anyone behind. So I want to say thank you for continuing this discussion. I expect the discussion to continue in the future, but for right now, I will ask for a no vote.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. I will turn it over to the committee for discussion. First up, we have Representative Backer.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your feedback there, Chair Fisher. At the same time, I'm going to respectfully disagree. I know we talked about this just a couple of days ago. There is value in work outside of what they get paid. And I know you care about it. I know Representative Baker cares about it. And I would ask for support for Representative Baker's amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair Fisher. You know, speaking to this amendment, I know we talked a little bit about this the other day, but there really seems to be this idea out there that we have, it's this program this way or the highway. There's no other alternative. That's the message I'm hearing, and that's just not true. There are a variety of ways that we support people, support our neighbors with disabilities, provide jobs for people. I have a very difficult time with the subminimum wage, which some people call special minimum wage, which I think is a cute way of saying we think we're doing something nice for you by getting cheap labor. I have a very, very difficult time with that. And I will say, I recognize and I've seen and I know hundreds of people who work in these jobs. This was the bulk of the work that I did prior to legislature. I visited the places that we're talking about. I know personally people who have jobs where they make subminimum wage. And I'm here to say that, yes, the work is rewarding. And sure, people are making some money on it. But at the end of the day, we're paying folks subminimum. and marketing that as some great opportunity for people with disabilities to just, you know, like it's some sort of favor. We have other options. And, you know, if the thing is that, you know, we want to be rewarded for good work, why doesn't that apply to the rest of us? You know, can we go home and feed our families with a gold star for doing a great job for the day? I don't think so. And so that's, you know, where I'm coming from on this issue. I strongly oppose this amendment, and I encourage other members to do the same.
Thank you. Next up is Representative Baker.
Thank you. I appreciate the comments, and maybe to Representative Curran, I understand. Maybe my question is, maybe I'm a realist when I think that the 33 or so hundred now that are in that subminimum, special minimum, whatever you want to call it, it is a special wage for people with special needs, and they need special things that help them, right? They just need that whole thing. My question is, can you guarantee me that nobody will lose their ability to work when this ends? Because if you can, I'll support it. My concern is, I'm hearing from experts out there that do this all the time, there will be some people that will have nothing to go to. So help me with that. Can you? How can you guarantee that that will happen? And that's what I'm trying to get to, is if we have that, then let's continue to work with that. Chair Fisher has offered this is going to be continuing on. This will be, I agree. But if we do this today, it's likely not going to be, because there's an ending to it, and it'll just be like too many other things we do. So that's my question, is that how can we guarantee there won't be 200 people left that now don't have anything, and when in 4 years or so we'll be hearing they have nothing to do? So help me with that, I guess, any member. That's my concern, and that's why I bring it forward, is for these special cases that might need different options, and I'd like to find more options. Thank you, and I hope you support my amendment.
I'll just share with the committee, too, that I've had people in my district bring concerns forward, similar concerns to what you're sharing with Representative Baker, but I've also had people in my community that made the choice years ago to move away from subminimum wage, and there were absolutely fears in that time that all of a sudden nothing else was going to be an option. I can say, at least in my community, in my district, that was not the case, but I can certainly understand the fears. But I guess to keep Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Frederick. And Representative Baker, for your amendment. I just wanted to say, you know, we've heard a couple times that there is value to work beyond getting paid, and I don't actually think that's true unless you're getting paid enough to meet all of the needs that you have. The purpose of work is getting paid. That's why it's called work. That's what we do it for. When we have enough money to live the lives that we so choose to live, okay, then we can talk about the value we extract from the meaning in our work. I think most of us here understand that we're here because we find value in the work. But we're talking about work, and we need to treat it like work. When we pay people for work, we should pay them the rate of the work. It doesn't matter who they are. That's what I believe. I'm not an expert in the spaces that we're talking about, but if we're talking about work, we're talking about people's labor and the value of it. And I don't really think we need to continue to extract it, whether or not they're living with disabilities, whether or not they are incarcerated. Work should be recognized and paid for based on the value of the work, not the value of the individual that we place on. And it's really difficult to listen to. So I just wanted to make sure we understood that. Also, anybody who guarantees you the outcomes are going to be the way that they foresee, they're not making policy, honestly. We're trying our best to help people based on what we're hearing. There are no guarantees for anything that we do here. So it's a standard I would like us to try to acknowledge.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Baker, you're obviously, you and I are friends, and I get where you're coming from on this, but I think at our time at the legislature, this has been around for 6 years since I've been here. And I think we know when an issue is not ready, and we know when it is, and I will tell you that it's ready. From my perspective, this bill is ready to go. People have worked very hard on it from years. We're starting to see the exit out, and I think it's a value statement now. So I'm not going to vote for your amendment, and I hope that honestly that at the end of the day that you'll support this, because I think your heart is there. And I think that there's fear in this, as we sit in this table, and there's a fear on a lot of things that we do. But I think it's right to push forward.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. And I agree with Representative Edelson. I think your heart is in the right place. But today I've heard people say things like the experts and special. And the experts aren't the providers. They're the people working. And they don't see themselves as special. They see themselves as people who are living in a world that does not recognize the natural occurrence of disability. There are people who are born with different disabilities, and they may be physical, they may affect their minds, they may affect their bodies. And then there are people who acquire them with age. And there are people who are diagnosed with things later in life, and children who are diagnosed with things. There are people who are in horrific accidents that leave them in a different space. None of those people view themselves as special. They view themselves as living in a world that is not designed for them. And the experts, the providers, are doing their absolute best, and they are wonderful people. But they aren't the people working at less than minimum wage. And I don't think that anyone is the villain in this scenario. But I do think that we have in the disability community for a long time used a protectionary lens. We wanted to take care of and protect and parentify people with disabilities, adults with disabilities. And what this movement says is we know they can, and the numbers show us they can, because they have been. And at some point, we just have to say, we know they can, we know they will, and we assume competence. Because right now, and for many, many decades, we have assumed incompetence. We have assumed can't instead of will. And when you set the expectation that people can and they will, they strive to. And when we say you can't and you won't, you don't. And so I don't think anybody's the villain here. But I do think that it's time. It's time to say, we believe you can, we believe you will, and we think you can get there. So I will be voting no on your amendment.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members, and thank you, Representative Baker, for bringing this conversation up again. I've remained largely quiet on this issue this year in an attempt to make sure that I created enough space for more voices to be heard on this. And I think this year is a reflection that it wasn't just one representative bringing it. It's a reflection, like Representative Edelson said, of years of this leading up to it. It's a reflection of a new class of legislators who have come in and came into this work with this at the forefront of their mind. So this body did so much work and has taken so much time to work on it that at least two classes of new legislators have started this job with this as a priority. And so when we think about what the public is seeing on that, I think we have, to Representative Edelson's point, we have done the due diligence. I think we have taken so much time to be thoughtful. And I keep hearing about, you know, a better plan. I've yet to see one come before us. Last year, we did see somewhat of a better plan kind of emerge, which was great, and that's what we needed. We took action on that. At this point, we have listened to the concerns. We've listened to people from every side of this issue. And I mostly, at the end of today's hearing, want us to remember that the phase out for this is in 2028. We'll be in another presidential election by the time this actually phases out. And how much more time shall we take? None of us have a crystal ball. None of us can predict what's going to happen. To Representative Finke's point, there are no guarantees in this work. I do know, though, that I am immensely proud of my caucus for moving the way they have on this and for really extending the fight for labor rights to the disability community. This is a labor issue, and I'm really grateful for our labor partners who have joined in. I know some are in the audience and listening. Thank you for that. And thank you to all of the parents and the people who are affected by this who've come forward to speak about this. As all you know, I could go on and on about this issue because I am so deeply passionate about it. But ultimately, I will respectfully ask for a no vote on the amendment because I do think it's time.
Representative Baker, final thoughts, and we'll go to the vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to have the conversation. I appreciate the conversation. I really do value your opinions, your positions. I know this has been a work in progress. I'm like a lot of folks, I'm just nervous and scared. So I just want to bring it up to the table. That's where I'm at, and I know this will not succeed today. Thank you for the time.
Thank you. And with that, we will vote. All those in favor of adopting the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, say nay.
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 No. Motion is not adopted. Next up, we have the A3 amendment being offered also by Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a, I think it should be a friendly amendment to my friend Chair Fisher. This is something we worked on last year. This is kind of a continuation of allowing a little bit more elbow room for our folks in the opioid treatment programs to take on a few more clients. There was a state limit of 50 in the past. We rose it to 60 last year with a one-year kind of a plan. This kind of allows the providers to keep it up at that 60 level based on the provider trust to be able to manage this. So, Mr. Chair, I would hope that you could help me with the passage of A3 today.
Chair Fisher, your thoughts.
Thank you, Vice Chair Frederick. Representative Baker, yes, I wholeheartedly support this. I want to say thank you for the work you did on this last year. I will say last year you kind of pushed me a little bit out of my comfort zone because I was kind of like, oh, geez, I don't know, is this too much? And I want to say thank you for that. Thank you for giving me the facts, giving me the information so I could get to that point and say, let's give it a try. I'm very excited to see this is done. I'm so glad you're bringing it forward. I wholeheartedly endorse it.
Thank you.
Discussion to A3 amendment. Not seeing any. All those in favor of adopting the A3 amendments, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Motion is adopted. We have the A4 amendment being offered by Representative Finke.
Yes, thank you. Sorry. Chair Frederick, I move my amendment.
Would you like to introduce your amendment?
Yes, please. So this amendment, chairs and committee members, is a proposal that the statewide PCA provider association has been working on and has discussed with most members of the committee due to an unexpected issue with the chief clerk rejecting our companion jackets to the Senate bill. We're here introducing it as an amendment. This amendment was heard in the other body with no testimony and no letters of opposition. It's anticipated it will be added to the Senate omnibus bill today, now that it is confirmed to be budget neutral. So that's just the background. The amendment ensures that people with disabilities who turn 65 do not lose their PCA provider when their PCA services switch to being paid by managed care instead of fee for service. It's especially important for small, culturally specific providers to ensure people with disabilities can access the best and most appropriate care. This will reduce churn in the system and administrative burden while ensuring that people have a choice in what provider they work with. I would appreciate your support.
Chair Fisher, your thoughts?
I would accept this amendment.
Sounds good. Is there any discussion in the committee? Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you, Representative Finke. I love this. Continuity of care is super important. Side note, I would just like to point out that people should be able to keep their providers and pick their providers regardless of how their state-funded federal Medicaid is paid.
Any other discussion? Not seeing. All those in favor of adopting the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, say nay. Motion is adopted. Next up, we have the A6 amendment being introduced by Representative Baker.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. This is my last one, I think, for the day, right? I think that's where we're at. So this is, again, it's going to sound familiar, and I want to talk about this because I have learned more since our last committee hearing about the importance of a sober home mandated to provide sort of a bit of a unlimited amount of or anything prescribed to a person who is recently out of treatment, who is choosing to live in a sober community. And there are trickinesses that are very unique about this community. Since our last meeting, again, I offered it up to my friend, Chair Frederick, about this. It was not accepted then. What I've learned was I went to a sober home after the last meeting, and briefly we talked about the what-if medically assisted therapies that are being really shown to be making a big difference, but the other stuff that can be a little bit more easily abused or, you know, not used like it should is a real thing in sober homes. We had a very good conversation. I happened to be with Jeremy Drucker there from the governor's addiction office. I'm not suggesting he's supporting what I'm saying today. I'm just saying we had a really nice meeting with some gentlemen around the table. This is important to talk about because the community is asking us, and our folks from MASH, the Association of Sober Homes, have said, we're behind you with 90% of what you're doing here, getting the therapies, the Suboxone, the methadone, that sort of healing is really helping a lot of people. But there's some homes that literally are not set up yet for the other things that are making them extremely nervous. And if we force them and don't give them a choice, it's not going to be good or right for that particular sober home. I just want to make sure it's talked about. Chair Frederick, we have a meeting about this tomorrow. And you are a rock star on this issue. I want to make sure that as we go into that tomorrow, which I'm looking forward to, this was ahead of that. So I was just like, you know, I want to get it here. But my intention today, folks, is just to say this is important. This is not a slam dunk. It's not easy. I'm going to withdraw the amendment today because I don't want to take more time than it needs to. But I've learned more. I'm looking forward to tomorrow. I want to thank all the advocates that are helping to come to this position of finding the right place. But we have to be very careful because those homes are very, very, I don't want to use the word fragile too much because it's not. They're doing great work. And I just want to make sure we don't push people to a place where not everybody is ready. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll withdraw the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Baker. I was just thinking to myself that I'm itching to respond to this, but I've been turning it over to Chair Fisher the whole time, and I was going to let him talk first. But I also am looking forward to that meeting. I will say that I've gotten many emails since we heard that this bill in this committee from different groups that also want to. So it's grown into a bigger group than I'd initially intended, but we're talking discussions from the Governor's Opiate Council. They're going to have people there from the RCO, from the sober homes, from the medical community. There's as many voices as we could to bring to that table to have that discussion. I'm equally looking forward to it and continuing the work.
Thank you.
The A6th Amendment is withdrawn. And that's all of them. Overall discussion though?
We did the opposite.
All right. At this point, we'll turn it over to the committee for overall testifiers. We got who's up? Matt Burdick from DHS. And then on deck will be Sarah Grafstrom. I'd like to introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record again, Matt Burdick with the Department of Human Services. I'll be very brief. Mostly just want to thank Chair Fisher and this committee for the great work on this policy omnibus bill. Especially grateful for the inclusion of all of the DHS policy language that is germane to this committee and the time and attention you all spent helping us make that language better. In particular, I want to highlight the nurse facility transparency pieces, the special minimum wage phase out issues that we've been talking about, as well as I make a personal thanks for the expiration of outdated and expired reports that will make a huge difference in the lives of myself and our team back at the department so that we can focus on more pressing matters that are before the committee. Do just want to note there are a couple of sections we're still working with members and proponents on. The first is Article 1, Sections 5 and 6. We've actually got a meeting with the proponents of that later today. And then do want to continue talking about Article 5, Section 22, which removes limitations on certain take-home doses for opioid treatment programs. But overall, just very grateful for the work of this committee and look forward to continuing to work with you all as this moves ahead.
Sounds good. Thank you. Up next, we have Sarah Grafstrom, and then on deck will be Josh Berg. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 4392. For the record, my name is Sarah Grafstrom. I'm the Senior Director of State and Federal Policy with ARM. Yesterday was Disability Services Day at the Capitol. We had over 1,000 advocates here, hopefully meeting with many of you, sharing their vision of how disability services can support people where, how, and when they choose, and talking about some of the obstacles that are in the way of that. This session, ARM brought forward a list of legislative priorities that tried to address some of those obstacles, and we are grateful to see many of those priorities included in House File 4392. First, we want to thank the chair for including language exempting both 245D and 144G homes from municipal rental licensing requirements. These requirements are redundant to state and county requirements and can be used as a tool to discriminate against people with disabilities. By eliminating the ability for a city to require a rental license for these homes, you are helping to ensure that people have the right and choice to live in whatever community they want. ARM was also thrilled to see the provisions in Article 1, Section 9 of the bill allowing for out-of-home respite for children in an unlicensed setting. This provision has been a priority of ARM for the last 4 years, and I want to take a moment to thank the department for their work with us on this language and their collaboration in finding a solution to increase access to respite for children. Expanding options for out-of-home respite will support families in finding options for their children in their own communities and avoid other crisis options. Finally, I just want to take a moment to highlight and express our strong support for two additional pieces of the bill. Article 1, Section 3 through 7 make changes within 245D to amend some worker qualifications and support workforce growth. And Article 1, Section 12 and 13 of the bill support the further advancement of assistive technology for people with disabilities by laying out clear timelines for the approval or denial of the service. I want to thank again the chair and committee members for the opportunity to provide comments on the Human Service Omnibus Policy Bill and for your thoughtful consideration and collaborative work that went into the development of these proposals that ARM brought forward this session. We're grateful for the leadership of the chair and committee members in developing meaningful policy changes that impact people with disabilities and their service providers.
Thank you. Next up is Josh Berg, and on deck is Tim Walsh. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Josh Berg, and I am with a nonprofit based here in St. Paul called Accessible Space. I won't take up much of your time as well, and I echo a lot of what Mr. Burdick had mentioned. First, thank you, Chair Fisher, for bringing forward this omnibus policy bill that captures several impactful bills that you've heard in this committee this session. I submitted written testimony that speaks to some of the specific provisions and sections, so I won't go into those, but wanted to say a special thank you related to HF 3938 in regards to the rental license exemption language. And I give you my word that I will continue to work alongside my local government colleagues, the League, Metro Cities, to make sure that it's implemented and works well. I also wanted to say thank you, Mr. Chair, and all of you for including the language related to the subminimum wage elimination. Minnesota leads in so many areas as it relates to supporting individuals with disabilities, and this was not one of them. Minnesota, or states across the nation, are further ahead than we are, and this language reinforces the plan that is already being implemented and is already working. The plan is there, it is working, and I encourage you to resist the urge, this was written before, to amend it out. I reinforce you for making the choice that you did. And I would just throw out there, I chaired the Disability Equity Committee within the Governor's Workforce Development Board, and we are always looking for members, new members, to join that discussion. And this is one of the topics and the issues that we will be addressing through our work with the National Governors Association and the Learning Collaborative work that we're doing. Senator Hoffman is a member of that, so open invitation for anybody that has interest to join us in that work to find more employment options for individuals with disabilities. Special shout out to Nicole, Christy, and Ari with the department. Thank you to Natasha, Heidi, and the team for listening and working alongside us as we operationalize everything. And again, thank you to Chair Fisher and every one of you members and all of the staff for the work that you've done so far this session. Thank you for the work that you do on a day-to-day basis advocating for individuals with disabilities. But even more than that, thank you for how you go about that work. I appreciate the conversations and the discussions that you all have here about very important, passionate, emotional conversations and discussions. And I just want to express that's not the case in a lot of committees, as you probably know. And there's a lot of other things that happen. This is not one of those committees. We come in here and we know that you all have the intentions to serve more Minnesotans better, and I appreciate that, and I just want to continue to reinforce how you guys go about the work that you are doing. So thank you again. I appreciate you. We all appreciate you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up is Tim Walsh, and then on deck is Beth Davis. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tim Walsh. I'm the CEO of North Star Regional Treatment Services, and I am here on behalf of MARCH, but I'm also a member of MERITAP, and MERITAP supports the MARCH positions in this policy. We want to be especially thankful of Vice Chair Frederick and Chair Fisher for your support of the MARCH bills, and also Representative Baker. Also want to thank the DHS policy team. I don't know if you know all the behind the scenes, but they are really good about connecting with stakeholders, getting our opinions. We've been working on the reform of the SED system for over 7 years now, and I think with tremendous results. And so I just want to extend our thanks to the DHS policy team. We do want to highlight once again that the SED system, our whole reimbursement rates are just horrible. We have, as we said in our testimony last time, 45 programs have gone out of business in the last 2 years. We're averaging 2 programs per month that are going out of business because of those rates. We have the most recent study by Burns and Associate that says the rates should increase on an average of 68%. I just want to highlight that. So I want to talk about some of the things that we especially are thankful for in House File 4392. It does provide relief for some of the staffing requirements. We appreciate that. It provides direct access for people and eliminates any unnecessary barriers that people have of getting into treatment and choosing the provider of their choice. It aligns with the ASAM, the American Society of Addiction Medicine requirements, and also moves forward our whole the report and the recommendations for paperwork reduction, administrative simplification, and it's going to reduce that burden. The one strong exception that we have to the bill is under Section 18, line 63.26, and what that does is it changes the ASAM 3.1 level of care, low intensity residential, from 5 hours a week to 9 to 19 hours per week. So that's one of the reasons we give you the backdrop for how horrible our rates are right now. This language will double or triple the amount of treatment services needed to be provided at a rate of less than $80 per day. If this language moves forward, we strongly request a match of the old medium intensity rate, and that was $166.13, and or the preferred proposed rate from Burns and Associates of $216.90. We look forward to ongoing work and collaboration with DHS and this committee to make systemic improvements to the substance use disorder field. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next is Beth Davis. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chairperson Frederick. Today, I'm representing Rachel Davis, who is my daughter. Excuse me, I'm a little nervous. I got a talking to from Rachel. She's 31. She is someone who has worked for 31 years in some minimum wage and struggled. She was diagnosed with a condition called Rubenstein baby syndrome when she was 1 year old. She had surgery. She was being worked up to have surgeries to be for corrective surgery on her hands and feet to be functionally surgically have her bones worked on so she could functionally work someday. And they found a brain tumor. The brain tumor left her with a stutter and seizures. She's 31. For 8 years, we privately paid for therapies. The government didn't pay for them. I'm a nurse. I work nights. And I slept in the back of a van while she went to therapy. She now can articulate speech. She can communicate her needs. She reads at a seventh grade level. She doesn't always understand what she's saying, which can be kind of funny. Sometimes you get what you pray for when you get sass. She can advocate for herself. But it also, when she was working in a community in 2016, her Social Security reported that she earned $1,659 on a 1-4 team, and she had a good jobs coach working out in the community with her friends, and she felt valued. And then her coach got promoted, and her job site decided that they couldn't find any more coaches, and they put her in a warehouse where she did piece work for sub-minimum wage. And for 2 years, she put a wire in the hole of a plastic piece, and she was given quotas. And she was told that she could finish her quota, and then she was told she needed to sit on a stool. My daughter has rheumatoid arthritis. And for 7 hours, she was expected to stay on her stool. She could get up when she could go to the lunchroom. She was written up if she got up off of her stool to go to the bathroom more than twice. We were called because we were told that she needed to wear a diaper to work because she wanted to go to the bathroom more than twice. She was written up for going to a table to arrange paperwork, pictures of activity sheets, because one of her friends who is more severely disabled likes horses and wanted to color instead of sit quietly at the table because they didn't have work. Because her job site couldn't get piecework for them. And when they didn't have enough work and didn't have enough quota and everybody was done, or some of her crew who were more severely disabled were sitting trying to figure out their work, she wasn't allowed to help them. So at the end of the day, she would finish the work for them so they could get paid. That's what subminimum wage was like for her. And she'd come home and tell me, Mom, this isn't fair. And we were told that she wasn't employable. And I watched my daughter's self-esteem and her independence slowly disappear. In 2019, we finally were able to pull her out of that program, and we tried to put her into a different program. And that program was able to tell every other program we tried to transfer that she couldn't be employed. So she's volunteered since 2019. And she is working on getting someone to employ her. I really appreciate
it. Take the time that you need.
that you want to pay someone for a job, but you've got to know that someone's capacity to be productive life is not about disability or impairment, physical or mental capacity. My daughter is not mentally impaired. She's very smart. She knows when she has a seizure, she goes back to where she remembers she left off, and she picks up at that point. She is working very hard on discovering a job she can do, and then given the chance, she'll clean up your act. She is a card-carrying Democrat, and God help my Republican husband. I have to sit at the dinner table with the two of them. And it's going to be an interesting year. Gee, please talk to your Senate counterparts. We need to have something. We need to have some kind of different criteria for work in our communities for those, not only for the chronic disabled, but for the new disabled. And as a nurse, I see people all the time who become disabled, who can't. And they end up on the street. And they want to be a part, and they want to serve. Excuse me. And it's just about purpose. It's about wanting to afford bread. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming forward and sharing that story. I think it's stories like that that, you know, it definitely impact all of us and impact the policies that happen here. Any other members of the public that would like to come forward and testify? Turn it over to the committee for discussion. Representative Ellison.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative, or thank you, Chair Fisher, for bringing this bill. So the last testifier, I think you've made all of us feel with you. I don't cry very often here at the Capitol, and you made me cry. Your daughter sounds like an amazing person, and I'm so proud of you for being here today to speak for her. I think over the years, we are going to have to continue to look at exactly what you're saying, is making sure we have opportunities and we change what work looks like for a person with a disability so it opens it up, because I don't think just phasing it out is going to be enough. It will take us constantly reevaluating, which is why I wanted a report. Which Director Grom says a report on a report. I think there's already some reports. So this is my last year, but I do hope that as you guys look at this in future years, that we do look at if there's ways to grant businesses or whatever it is, that we continue to make sure that we build this up so we have a workforce around this. It's probably the most, you have a lot of really great things in this bill, but that one is, I think, the one that is really going to touch hearts and minds as it moves forward. So thank you.
Representative Engen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Fisher. It's always a pleasure to be in this committee and see a lot of good work in this bill, but wanted to clarify on lines 69.4 through 69.11 of the DE1. I'm reading about secure treatment facilities. We're going to be amending that title to a state-operated treatment program. And that includes the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Are those programs still secured? I'm curious because the name change would indicate that they're potentially no longer secure. I'm just wondering about that.
So I will say, as an employee of one of those facilities, the physical structure is not changing. Sorry, Chair Fisher.
No, I I will defer to those who've got more expertise in this area than I do, and I would say that you're spot on there. I would say if there's anyone from the department that has anything else to add on that, I would imagine anything that's secure now is going to remain secure going forward. And I'm seeing a nod from Director Burdick up there.
We'll have somebody come up from DHS. No? Director Brownist, if you want to introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
For the record, my name is Carrie Brownist, the Legislative Director for Drug Care and Treatment. I apologize. Yes, I was agreeing with you. There is no change.
Representative Ingen.
Great, thank you. Just wanted to clarify once I saw secure being slashed, just kind of put up a red flag, so thanks for the clarification.
Yeah, the name has changed in the last 20 years as well, kind of got come and gone, but the physical structure, I mean, a little bit of changes too, but not, I think, to the concerns that you're expressing. So not seeing any other discussion. Final thoughts, Chair Fisher.
I want to say thank you to the committee for the robust discussion we have had today, and very much want to thank all the testifiers, particularly Beth, who gave some very, very wonderful testimony. This is a bill that, while there's maybe some areas that may need still a little work or some concerns on, I think this has been a product that has been a lot of great work from everybody here on this committee, and I want to say thank you, everyone, for being involved with it. And with that, I would renew my motion that House File 4392, as amended, be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Chair Fisher moves that House File 4392 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee, or as amended, be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails. Next up, we have House File 3495. Chair Fisher, would you like to move and introduce your bill?
Thank you, Vice Chair Frederick. I move to adopt the DE3 Authors Amendment. As we are going through this process, I first want to thank Matt Burdick and Christy Grom from DHS for their help in putting this together, Sarah Sinneman from House Nonpartisan Staff, and all the great advocates and providers from the Mental Health Legislative Network who started this process a long time ago. Way before we even had, well, before we had the start of winter, I should say. I was going to say the start of snow, but we haven't had much. So I want to thank everybody for all the collaborative work we've had on this. This bill, the DE3 amendment, covers a lot of different bills in a lot of different areas. We're calling it the Comprehensive Solutions to the Mental Health Act. And I want to check my time here to make sure I'm not running too long. So I'm going to give a really, really high hit on this, and if you have further questions, getting hit in it. We have Article 1, which gets to the Mental Health Uniform Standards. This has got provisions in it from a bill that I carried and Chair Vang had offered. Article 2 is dealing with adult mental health services. It does some things, making sure we're addressing the clubhouse issue that Representative Edelson brought up earlier. Putting together engagement service pilot grants. Representative Baker has some provisions in here from the Assertive Community Eligibility Program. Representative Bierman has some items in here requiring rate changes for adult mental health services. Another Edelson bill adding occupational therapists to adult rehab and mental health areas. Article 3 is children's mental health areas. A lot of this came from my bills, which was the Mental Health Legislative Network one, and House File 4671 addresses children's mental health grant criteria for foster homes. It addresses a Bierman provision requiring psychiatric residential treatment facilities and intensive non-residential rehab treatment rates to include direct care staffing costs, new capital costs. It addresses the commissioner to use some expedited rulemaking to make specified amendments to rules governing children's residential facilities. Article 4 is the substance use disorders section. A lot of this comes from Representative Baker's bills 4190 and 4149, addressing MA eligibility, treatment for substance use disorders, modified to licensed alcohol drug and counselor education requirements. There are some new provisions in Articles 4, Sections 4 to 14, which address adding clinical trainee, mental health professional, and qualified health professional to definitions in Chapter 245G, and expanding who may perform SUD assessments. Skipping over to Article 5, housing supports was from Representative Edmondson Yeager. It's a DHS policy bill about general assistance and housing supports, clarifying changes, aligning housing support cost neutral, transfer program standards, and it's got a repealer. And then Article 6 is a miscellaneous article, and that has to do with several bills from Representative Vang, her, myself, Edelson, Representative Edelson, Representative Hemmingson Yeager, doing things from establishing mental health and substance use disorder education center, Department of Health, expanding eligibility of mental health supervision grants, increasing medical assistance payments for outpatient medical services, requiring establishment of an application of certification process for specified mental health service providers, more DHS policy modifying behavioral health home service provider and service delivery standards, and requiring Commissioner of Human Services to consult with listed stakeholders to develop recommendations to move mental health grants to formula-based structure instead of grants. And then finally, Article 7 is appropriations. This addresses bills from Representative Edelson, Representative Hicks, and myself, increasing mobile home crisis grants, grants to Intercultural Multi-Assistance Association for Somali Mental Health Program, engagement service pilot grants, protected transportation startup grants, respite care service grants, and also addressing in-home children's mental health infrastructure grants and rates. And that is a very quick high level of the DE3.
So just for the sake of process, Chair Fisher moves to refer House File 3495 to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee, and now to the DE3 amendment. Is there discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of adopting the DE3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. The ayes have it. DE3 is adopted.
Very good. And then Chair Fisher. I have an author A4 amendment, if I could author.
If you would like to introduce the amendment, Chair Fisher.
Yes, I'd like to move the author's A4 amendment. This amendment was in consultation with the advocates here. What we're doing is we're moving $5 million to add in a couple of things for in-person juvenile detention facilities, taking that from zero to 2.5. And then there was one other area that we were moving the dollars to, and I'm sorry, my computer kind of rolls up. Transfer? I'm sorry.
I think it was for the...
All right.
Chair Fisher.
Mobile transfer units gets 2.5, and the... other grants get 2.5, which reduces the mental health infrastructure grants by $5
million. Discussion to the A4 author's amendment. Not seeing any. All those in favor of adopting the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. A4 amendment is adopted. At this point, we will turn it over to testifiers. First up, we have Hui Yang, and on deck will be Sue Abderholden.
Welcome. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Yes, Pahua Yang. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3495. This bill consists of several valuable proposals that will bring quality mental health and SUD services to many Minnesotans across the state. My name is Pahua Yang. I am Vice President of Community Mental Health and Wellness at the Wilder Foundation, a community mental health clinic providing a spectrum of supports through our one-stop shop model of services. Today, I am here speaking on behalf of our statewide community of mental health providers, organizations striving to provide quality treatment to Minnesotans from all walks of life. First, we are grateful for the inclusion of the Medicaid outpatient rates proposal. We continue to experience a more severe mental health and SUD care access crisis coming out of the global pandemic. People, adults, children, and families are coming to us with more needs and with higher levels of acuity, while our clinics are at lower staff capacity with fewer resources than before. At the root of this crisis is the lack of sustainable reimbursement funding for our mental health and SUD care sector. While we need a multi-pronged approach, addressing rates can help turn the tide on this crisis. Costs of delivering care and sustaining staff salaries, benefits, facilities, infrastructure, and meeting state regulations have increased exponentially. Having just completed our own budgeting process at Wilder for next fiscal year, I can absolutely confirm that these increases far outpace any increase we are expecting on the revenue side. And having spoken to many of my colleagues, I know that this is not a unique situation. I think we can see where this trajectory is headed and the implications for our entire mental health and SUD delivery system if reimbursement doesn't catch up to the cost of service delivery. In addition, the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs conducts biannual statewide salary surveys. And based on this information, we know that since 2018, licensed psychologist salaries have increased 32%, psychiatrists 62%, 25% increases for other licensed mental health professionals, such as social workers, marriage and family therapists, and counselors, and 51% for unlicensed practitioners. But Medicaid, or medical assistance reimbursements, which are the core source of funding for our Minnesota mental health and SUD treatment system, are not keeping pace, lagging on average 40% behind the costs of delivering care. Out of necessity, our community providers are closing programs or significantly decreasing their services in efforts to keep some base level of access to services available to our communities. This is resulting in increasingly long wait lists and longer periods of time clients are kept waiting for care and children boarding in hospital emergency departments. All of us in this room have someone we care deeply about, and I want you to imagine what it feels like to watch your loved one suffering and be told that there just isn't capacity and that they have to somehow hold their pain for another month, another several months, or indefinitely until someone somewhere has an opening to see them. I'd like to share that I actually don't need to imagine that because I'm there right now. This past summer, two of my kids were on a wait list at a clinic, and I got a call from the clinic letting me know that they were eliminating their wait list because they knew that there was no way that they could get to everybody on that wait list. So out of ethical obligations, they were eliminating their wait list. And we had to start all over again on someone else's wait list. And even as an industry insider who is really working to figure out how we can meet community needs at my organization, I can't do a darn thing to help my own babies. And I have access to more supports and resources than most people. There are very, very real life and death circumstances when people can't get their mental health and chemical health needs met in a timely manner. That is the heaviness that families and providers live with on a daily basis across all of Minnesota. These are heartbreaking and impossible situations and decisions folks are needing to make every day. These problems exist now. They've existed for years. And we can't keep waiting for political expediencies, larger budgets, different budget targets to act. Thankfully, we have some real opportunities this session to provide much needed relief. And every day of inaction costs not only our society, but our families. Your inclusion of provisions that decrease administrative burden, support staff to work at the top of their licensure, and invest in staff development can meaningfully address the crisis of staff burnout we are experiencing. Although people do not come as separate sets of symptoms, we struggle to serve people as whole humans with whole families. We appreciate all the ways that this bill is taking steps to eliminate barriers and build our capacity to provide care across silos so that people can get what they need. By fixing rates and incrementally modernizing a mental health system for the future, this bill is creating hope that our system can meet today's needs and conduct critical early interventions and the outpatient and intensive treatments that make for healthy communities. In addition to addressing rates, there are also a number of regulatory issues that this legislation addresses, such as allowing brief diagnostic assessments and assessments conducted by hospitals and our crisis teams to qualify kids for therapeutic services before a full diagnostic assessment is needed, which would open up access to so many kids and families. Updating the renewal requirement for diagnostic assessments in CTSS and ARMS services, which are psychiatric rehab services for kids and adults, to align with the changes currently found in our 245I or the current statute governing our outpatient mental health services, and updating the qualifications for clinical trainees to include folks who have completed their programs but are still waiting for license so that people can be employed as soon as they graduate. This legislation provides many proposals that allow community provider agencies and clinics, including Wilder, to keep moving forward toward an integrated holistic care model. It seeks critical investments and reforms to our reimbursements. And truly, our hope is to bring our services together around our communities. We hope the system will trust and support us in providing the care that is best for our communities. Thank you so much for your leadership and support.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up is Sue Abderholden. I will let everybody know we did get clearance to go past a little bit of time, but I am going to ask all of the rest of the testifiers to be as brief as you can. We're not setting a timer, but brief is good. Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. You have heard a number of times in this committee that our mental health system is in crisis. Just today we learned that North Memorial is closing its outpatient treatment program in August, and they have around 27 to 30 therapists, so a lot of thousands of people will be losing their care. Children and adults are waiting far too long to access the right level of care at the right place at the right time. The Mental Health Legislative Network has again worked together to bring to the legislature our solutions to the crisis. This is one of the bills that reflects our priorities this session. This bill recognizes there is no one easy answer to addressing this crisis. There are multiple actions that need to be taken to help Minnesotans struggling with their mental health. We need to go upstream. We can't keep waiting until someone was in crisis, a danger to themselves or others, in the ER or in the jail. This means focusing on our children's mental health system, since half of all mental illnesses begin by age 14. And that means funding the voluntary engagement program to try to engage someone in treatment and prevent a crisis. We also need to address our workforce shortages. We can't increase access without more people doing the work. There are sections in this bill that will help, creating a center at the health department, focusing on building our workforce in numbers and diversity, making sure the supervision grants go to rural Minnesota, and clarifying that a clinical trainee includes someone who's simply waiting to take their tests for the results. We do have to rely on grants for our mental health system, and the funding for mobile crisis teams needs to be consistent into the next biennium. We can't have this important service cut. Putting some startup funding for protected transport to take the pressures off of EMS and transport people with dignity. And then finally, developing recommendations to see if we can move some grants to formulas in order to free up the time and resources it takes to submit and monitor grants. I can't underscore this enough. Our mental health system is in crisis, and we can't wait until next year or the year after that. The legislature needs to take action this year. This bill contains many provisions that could help begin to address the crisis, and I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next is Todd Archbold, and on deck is Abby Morgan. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Todd Archbold. I'm a social worker and the CEO of Prairie Care. I'm here to share my support of the Comprehensive Solutions to Mental Health Act. Prairie Care operates the state's largest mental health hospital for youth and young adults, along with a comprehensive network of outpatient programs. We have nearly 900 team members and have cared for more than 100,000 individuals. We exist today in an era when mental health needs are at an all-time high. Rates of suicide and deaths by overdose have reached record levels. Prairie Care is one thread in the fabric of our state's mental health care system, and together, we create a beautiful tapestry that is able to care for our kids, their families, and all those at risk. We have solutions. Yet sadly, at a time when our communities need us the most, programs are closing. Beds are being taken offline, professionals are leaving the field, and emergency rooms are overwhelmed with psychiatric crisis. This is a direct result of poor reimbursements and a Medicaid rate that pays far less than the cost to deliver care. So we appreciate the consideration of the rate increases. Another painful symptom in this crisis is children boarding in hospitals and emergency departments. A year and a half ago, our beleaguered provider community came together to help solve this problem. Through a grassroots initiative, we launched the Mental Health Collaboration Hub, an initiative designed to identify viable care pathways for children who are stuck boarding. Together, we have connected hundreds of children to the treatment they need. This bill's investment in rates can build the needed service fabric to expand the collaboration and innovation needed to help all of our children, especially the most challenged. The reality is that many psychiatric crises are preventable with early intervention, and the unacceptable wait times for care can be decreased. Let's stop admiring this problem and let's solve it. Help us bolster community capacity and capabilities, including more access to preventative care and increasing our ability to treat more difficult cases. Thank you.
Thank you. Up next is Abby Morgan, and on deck is Ann Henderson. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name is Abby Morgan, and I am the clinical supervisor with the Nexus Youth Care Transition Team. I'm here today representing mental health providers statewide, and I have a perspective from serving as a leader in multiple mental health settings. My team serves youth through the state that have been identified as difficult to serve. We have seen multiple children boarding in the emergency department for over 100 days. Today's Comprehensive Solution to Mental Health Act underscores that we have a solution to our children's mental health crisis. The solution includes innovative, individualized treatment spanning across the continuum of care and relies on updated Medicaid rates. Fixing rates can support prevention by assuring access to early intervention and intensive community services. Family-centered in-home services included in this proposal are very effective in supporting the child and family, including mobile transition teams, uniquely designed to support children who are boarding in hospitals to return home with needed services. Recently, our mobile transition team served a youth who hadn't gone to school in 4 months due to mental health concerns and heavy substance use. Within only 24 hours of receiving the hospital referral, our team had transitioned this youth back to their home with comprehensive services in place. Ongoing support of mobile transition teams could increase the capacity to serve youth that are also boarding in detention centers and inpatient hospitalization. Thank you for including respite in this bill. The intensity of serving a youth with these high mental health needs at home can really, truly be exhausting. Respite care helps preserve families and maintain treatment to give breaks to both the youth and the caregivers. And we appreciate that this bill seeks to support our full continuum. As the previous director of a residential treatment center, I am grateful for your preservation of the children's residential treatment centers in this amendment. The service is a vital component of our continuum. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next is Ann Henderson. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3495. My name is Ann Henderson. I'm the CEO of Mental Health Resources. Mental Health Resources is a nonprofit mental health agency providing community-based mental health services, outpatient, co-occurring substance use disorder treatment, and supportive services to more than 11,000 people annually. As a community mental health agency, Mental Health Resources provides a spectrum of mental health and substance use disorder services to our community, including care and assertive community treatment, ACT teams. MHR began providing ACT services in 2006, almost 18 years ago when it first became available. We have three teams that support people in Ramsey, Hennepin, and Dakota counties. At any given time, we are providing care for approximately 190 Minnesotans who live with severe and persistent mental illness and significant barriers to living satisfying lives, including poverty, housing insecurities, interfacing with the criminal justice system, food insecurities, social isolation, among many other issues. ACT teams are dynamic, multidisciplinary teams that wrap psychiatric care and social services around people who have often the most severe of psychiatric illnesses and without ACT are often found in institutions or on the street. In this current workforce crisis and state and national mental health crisis, MHR is further challenged in keeping access available to ACT services for our communities, spending staff time and energy away from care while trying to comply with prescriptive and sometimes conflicting regulations governing ACT. Team leaders spend time requesting and keeping up with variances for staff turnover, and staffing patterns are set according to statutory requirements versus client needs. Valuable clinical time is spent repeating assessments according to statutory requirements, regardless of clients' immediate needs. On top of that, the requirement for a team leader to be licensed at a time where we know that standardized exams, including licensing exams, are inherently racist, and the workforce crisis is a very real issue for us. We believe that reducing this barrier by taking away the requirement for an ACT team leader to be licensed would be a way to address a barrier without compromising the integrity of care. This legislation proposed changes MHR and many ACT providers and partners within the Mental Health Legislative Network hope to help us sustain access to our existing programs across Minnesota for clients. Acknowledging the good work that you and the legislature started last year to update our ACT programs in Minnesota, Mental Health Resources looks forward to continuing work with you, the department, and other community partners to keep ACT programs in Minnesota accessible for the communities we are serving. Thank you for your leadership and support.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public looking to testify? Gonna guess not. Okay, so I will turn it over to the committee. I will say very briefly, Representative Backer, I appreciate your dedication to the committee here.
My team's left me, okay?
They've given me the ability to speak on their behalf.
I take it the same way.
That's like 10 minutes per member here, Noah. I do have a question here, if I may, Chair.
Sure, Representative Backer.
And if we look at Section 9, Article 3, Section 9, can you, Chair Fisher, that's on page 37, share with us, help us to understand these changes for the rulemaking and why this is, what went behind this to make this change, what came up, what problem are you looking to solve? And You can phone a friend. She can talk for a half an hour.
Could probably do it quicker than I can.
Easy enough. If you want to state your name for the record and proceed.
Hello, my name is Kirsten Anderson with the Aspire Minnesota Chair, Representative Backer. So this came out of a lot of discussions with providers about Rule 2960 and a desire to incrementally change the rule to be much easier to implement and more congruent with practice today. And so we condensed the original proposal into a rulemaking language out of the desire to continue to have all of the language within the rule as opposed to our initial concept, which is to have incremental adjustments within statute and then the rule maintained.
Okay. Representative Backer?
That's good. And then one final question. If we go to line 6022, it talks about the CCBHC certified after September 31st, 2020 and before January 1st of 2021, the commissioner shall rebase rates according to this clause beginning of the dates provided after January 1st. What, you know, who did you have in mind? Who's going to be affected by this? Which of these are, because that seems like it's a cutout for somebody has something in mind. If you could share, please.
Do you state your name for the record and proceed, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ginny Palin with the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And Mr. Chair and Representative Backer, thank you for the question. Yes, you are correct. Last year when we changed the rebasing timeline for our CCBHCs, what we were not expecting while we were waiting for that to become effective with the state plan amendment is that two of our current CCBHCs were caught up in a situation where we had thought that 2024 was going to be the year that they would be rebased on. We were not anticipating that it was going to be retroactive and change their base year, and so this is a small fix for only two of the clinics so that they can keep their existing rebasing base year.
Representative Backer?
That's it. Thank you.
Representative Hicks.
I promise to be fast. On line 37.4, I know Representative Fisher, we've talked a little bit about this. I would really like to come back to the table to talk about that date. I know that the department needs time to get things in place, but October 1 of 2025 is 18 months away. And I'm really concerned that we don't have 18 months to have a plan to deal with children's residential mental health crisis stabilization. We're in crisis now. And so I'd love to have further discussion about that as we move this through. I'm really, really worried about it just being that far out.
Chair Fisher, any thoughts?
Yes, well, definitely. Let's have discussions, get together with the department. I know this is going over to health, finance, and policy, so we'd love to get this worked out before we hear it there.
Looks like there's no other committee discussion. Final thoughts, Chair Fisher.
I just want to thank everyone for their input on it, and I would like to renew my motion to re-refer House File 3495 as amended to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee.
All right. Chair Fisher renews his motion to re-refer House File 3495 as amended to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed say nay. The motion passes. All right. Chair Fisher, any final thoughts?
Okay, just real quickly, I want to thank everyone for all the work that we've had this past year. This is our last regular meeting. We're going to have at least one more meeting. I know there's a report or two that are coming out that we'll want to hear. I want to say thank you to all the staff that we've had out here. I know that we've got some great pages, Florence, Anwanto, Linda Christensen, thank you for your work this past year. Thank you, Jonathan Carter and Molly Peterson, who've been doing the work for our researchers on each side. Thank you to Ms. Pinelli up there for all her work as we put our bills together. And thank you to Nick Stuma-Langer and Spencer Kroos for staffing our committee. We've gotten a lot of great things done this year and looking forward to continue working on the bills that we've had going forward. So thank you.
And since I have the gavel right now, I get to also say thank you, Chair Fisher, for your leadership in this committee. So, seeing no further business, we are adjourned.